Okay, so this evening I'd like to explore the theme of gender, but really the theme of becoming my real self and what that means, and finding my real self, or our real selves. As I mentioned at the last Dharma seminar a year ago, this came up, the issue of gender, as being something painful where we are tested, we are challenged, we are shamed by the social world, we are given images, and we may not fit those images, and begins a journey of pain around the shape that we feel we're in. And the pain can be huge in relation to gender, but can be a huge pain facing who we are, who we really are in a world that challenges that, that doesn't see us, that doesn't accept, that puts us in the cupboard, in the closet, that wants to keep us there. So that's a really big issue. And the issue of labeling is really difficult. And gender is just an example, but it's happening all the time. Skin color, or where we come from, whatever, it's happening all the time. One of my grandchildren said to me, and I have 11, so I think I'm not being telling any secrets. They said to me, I'm working on what gender I want to be. I don't know. I thought, my God, I'm in another world here from the world of my childhood. So we need to give it respect because it's loud. It takes a lot of space in the consciousness. It takes a lot of space in the social discourse. It creates a lot of pain, these kind of issues of labeling and stereotyping and putting us in the cupboards and the boxes and the way people see us and the way we see ourselves. There's a huge pain in there. The mismatch, the hiatama, the mismatch between who we are, who we see ourselves, and the way we are seen by others. Right on the other side is the whole world of emptiness. The Buddhist teachings on emptiness seem like way far away from that. And anatta, no self, what does that mean? And are the two so far away that they can never meet? And a painful self, a painful me, painful because of gender or because of a persecution or oppression or denial or labeling. Does it help to know anatta, non-self, emptiness? And how? If so, how? So I want to give an example from a great master, not a Buddhist master, Advaita teacher, Ramana Maharshi, to give a sense of a direction here. So Ramana Maharshi is one of the greatest spiritual teachers of our time, now died. A huge, huge, inspiring figure and awakened soul. And many of us have been, including myself and Leela, have been on pilgrimage to where he taught and where he lived, Arunachala, in Tiruvannamalai. More than once, And I've been there several times, and many of us have. And he is in a place where he doesn't acknowledge a personal self, only a universal self, Atman. But how does the universal self appear? And the interesting thing is, he said, the way you practice is by being 100% honest about the existing self. Who am I? How am I appearing to myself in the present moment, moment by moment? So in other words, to go into the self as it is, in order to go through it to the other side. Not to go to the emptiness. Not to go to anatta, no self. Not to believe Buddhist teachings on no self. I got myself a little note here, because I like the English. It says, avoid the void. English speakers here might kind of catch the... avoid the void. Don't go there. This isn't the way to understand, to liberate the self by another teaching which the self enjoys called non-self. It's inspiring, but how do you really touch that place? And you touch that place by going into the self, by meeting the self, by meeting the self in all its forms and ways and messages and changes every 5 minutes, and the pain and the shame and the whole lot. But consistently, keep there and watch this self as it appears and as it appears again when we get up in the morning, we go to bed at night. Watch it, how it appears and how it dances and how it is. And gradually, that watching of the self shows you a place which is not that self. Because watching something makes you the witness of it. And the witness of the self is not the self. The witness of the self is much bigger than the self. Just like the witness, you know, I'm looking at that. So there's a bigger consciousness, I hope, that looks at that. The consciousness, a free consciousness, is looking at an object. The consciousness isn't the object. Otherwise, I couldn't look at it. So Ramana Maharshi, it's a beautiful example, because he was such a sacred, divine teacher, and he said, go into the self in order. The self is a primary thought. The self is the most dominant thought that we can have. The self thought takes up more space in the consciousness than any other thought. And if we can go into that and dissolve it, look at it and see the way it's a dance, it's not a thing, then everything, every thought, we can do it with anything. But of course, it's not so easy. So what are the tools that we need for that? Deep honesty. Deep inquiry. Seeing things just the way they are. Ready to look at things the way they are. Allowing them to be the way they are. Allowing this self, full of its stories and its shit and its complications and its past and its biography, letting it be what it is with honesty. And big tool of Dharma practice is that honesty. We're practicing it when we're meditating. When Leela said, just see the vibration of the word that you used in the go-round before. That's honesty. What is that word that came out of me spontaneously? You don't hear? You hear now? It's better? Maybe it should be up top here somewhere. How's that now? Okay. Just a very simple thing. When Leela suggested, check out the word. It came up in you. Spontaneous. The word arise. Honesty is that. Is saying, okay, let me look at its vibration. Let me look how it arose. Let me look at its energy. Let me look at the tether, the energy of this word that just appeared. How is it for me? It's honesty. So meditation includes a lot of honesty. And if we are honest, we have to see it. We, one way or another, we will notice how vulnerable we are, how shaky everything is in us, and how we are really trying to be comfortable in life, and how it's impossible, and how our, just the gender issue is an example, but it's millions of examples. And we, how much we play games, that we hide ourselves because we don't want to be seen as we really are. Shame is such a fundamental, painful emotion or experience that we all have, all of us. And it gets lighter perhaps, but every one of us has it. Even though likely a thought, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or I'm not good enough at that, or that should have, it, you know, this kind of voices in us, it's shame. It's like, I should be different. And they really, and all these voices, the shame and the doubt and the uncertainty of who we are, and the shakiness of things, and our response to that is trying to be comfortable, and very often creating walls where we try and be comfortable. Putting ourselves in boxes, putting ourselves in inside walls. So the honesty is the honesty of that story of the emperor's new clothes. You know the story, this kid's story of the Bagadima Chadashima HaKesar, Nachon? Shalamelech, yeah. Well, it's just, everyone is saying, is dishonest. All the adults, of course. The adults are saying, oh, yes, the king has a wonderful costume because they're afraid to say anything different from the consensus, Muzkamot. But it takes the child, and the child in us, the honest child, to say, wait a minute, the emperor, the Melech is naked. No one's courageous enough to see that. Honesty needs courage. But honesty is one of the main tools that we have. Honesty goes very, very deep. It says, things are the way they are. I look at things, you know, begova inayim. And it helps us to be authentic. I would say, besograim, that in the Dharma has quite a lot of trouble with the word truth, emet. There is, it is, satya is the Pali language for emet, for truth, and it's all kind of levels of truth. But really, because the whole Dharma is practice, is process, and not things, so truth is not a thing that is either right or wrong. It's something that appears to be true, or the word amiti, authentic, is the word we want here. Not emet, but amiti. And authenticity here is the name of the game. How we really are. And it's a really, really powerful, powerful practice. If you, I don't know if any of you have met Byron Katie or listened to her teachings, but that's basically all she says. And if you go to Korean Zen monasteries, that's all. The dominant message there is it really so? And that's the message of the Buddha too, again and again. Check it out. Is it really so? Ze bemet kacha? With every label, every definition, every view, every thought that we believe in, every label that we have, Palestinian, female, male, Orthodox, Haredi, right-wing, left-wing, whatever, the whole lot. Is it really so? Israeli, English. Is it really so? That's the authenticity. And there is a bridge between the painful positions of being labeled as a painful kind of self-image and the emptiness, which is far away. But the path between what joins them is this sense of authentic. Is it really so? It's very powerful. Finished a book and I'm quite excited because I just got the translation a couple of days ago to Hebrew. So one day it'll come out. And it really is about this. It's about really asking the question. It's a story. It's a roman. Roman autobiographic. But it really is about asking the question about the self, and as that happens, the self is deconstructed, piruk of the self, because you're asking, what is this self? And the piruk happens because when you ask the question, who am I, what is this self, every 5 minutes, every minute, you're going to get a different answer. The self is a huge collection, which is changing all the time, lefi ha-context. Lefi ha-heksher, lefi ze, lefi ze, lefi ze. Constantly we creating selfing. There isn't a self. There is a process of constant creation of selves, of many of them. We're a whole community, each one of us. Non-stop making many of ourselves. A whole collection of selves. That's all walking about, as the Buddha said. We're just a bunch of Daisa walking about, really, but actually thinking of ourselves as this. And we can watch that. We can watch the many selves appearing. And if we do that, then the ones that are painful, including the ones that are secret, that we don't want to tell people, but we don't want to admit because they may give us shame. And we all have them. But if we see that they're also part of that inner creation of so many selves, depending on the situation that we're in, it kind of, the whole thing gets easier. I hope we'll do some exercises in the next day or two, which involve these different meetings with self. And it, very, very simply, we can look in the mirror one moment and see ourselves as so beautiful, as a beautiful soul. And the next moment, look at ourselves and think, oh my God. That's terrible. What am I seeing? Oh my God. Quick, close it. Don't want to know. As we explore all the ways we create our multiple selves all the time and begin to be a friend of all these many, many selves that we are all the time creating and seeing. So we can do the same with others. And that's important because just as we don't like to be labeled by others, a gender label or any other label, we have to be aware not to do that with others too. It's really, really easy. It just happens like that. You almost can... just watch TV for a couple of evenings and you're already in that language. You can hardly avoid labeling that, those and those and those and those. What I'm saying is it's really not easy to avoid that. But it's just something we should be aware. So as we do that, though, as we become, shall we say, honestly inviting all our many selves to be seen and known and loved and allowed, including the ones that say shame and I want to be different and I don't like the self I am, and including those. So as we do that, we begin to uncover deeper layers of the self. We begin to see deeper messages that are perhaps more, shall we say, powerful. And we're going to be working on that too in this 2 or 3 days together. For example, primal archetypes that are just not so important anymore, whether we are ugly or beautiful or male or female or halfway in between or none of this and none of that, or Israeli or Palestinian or this or that, or tall or old or young or sick. Or underneath, we begin to see underneath layers that sustain us, that give us power if we touch them. Our archetypes, our sources, selves that are more sustainable, more not based on story or image, but more like a sense of being. And we can touch those levels, and they give us a lot of support. And slowly, slowly, when we do that, we begin to allow those places, we begin to love them, we begin to enjoy them, because they're our deeper self, they're our primal self. And then everything turns out okay. Somehow or other, we touch a deeper self and it seems all right. Some of you have heard this before, but it's my favorite quote from Eirut, the book I wrote. But I do like this quote. And therefore, I might have said it before, and I know you've heard it and others have heard it that have been with me for a while. But I'll say it anyway because there's some of you that don't know it. And it really is about this. I live next to lots of olive trees, which have an amazing expressive character that shows everything that has happened to them. If a branch has been cut, or if the tree reaches out in a certain direction, or there are lumps formed on the trunk, or the leaves are dried, you can see it. The shaping of the tree is its memory, its response to conditions. The tree doesn't have a problem with that. And there is no reason why we should have a problem either. We are also just shaped, constructed by life. We are given a body, and it develops and changes dynamically according to the conditions that arise. And we arrive in each moment as we are. And the world arises and meets us as it is. And all we need to do is to appreciate it and let it be. Our stories are just stories. Our narratives are just narratives. And our embodiment is just embodiment. If we let go into this flow of life, the wounds will dissolve, the scars will be softened and brought back to life, and we will find ourselves in the garden of the now instead of the prison of yesterday's. A difficult experience can come up, just like an unpleasant visitor. We can cry, but the next minute we can laugh, and then it's gone. If this opens up some subtle places, this inquiry, this honesty, this readiness to meet the self in all its levels and layers and changes. And we can find ourselves, in English you could say, in the world but not of the world. Meaning we are in the world but we're not depending on the world to give us its okay, to give us its to give us its approval, its okay. And it's important because there is actually the heart of Dharma. I never forget once being in a conference of Dharma teachers, this was like 15 years ago, in a Garrison Institute in America. And there was Bhikkhu Bodhi. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is, I would say, the number one translator of Pali texts in the Western world. And all the wisdom books, classical, thousands of Pali texts, the wisdom book publications of all the texts, they're all his. He's translated all of them and he's acknowledged to be sort of right up there. So you'd think that in the gathering and groups that we had, and I was in a few groups, small groups with him, that he'd talk about Buddha Dharma. No. He was talking about climate change. He was talking about inequality. He was talking about injustice and urgency about that, and angry, a bit angry as well. And forget all the books. He was on fire. And somewhere or other, we need to find a balance where this inquiry into the deeper self that we are can help us also in daily life where we meet difficulty, prejudice, anger, hate, violence. We have to kind of develop a wise way. So when we have something like gender, the gender issue, can we, without pushing it away, can we find in the Dharma practice a way of relating that gives it its full acknowledgement, but yet we can hold it with a big consciousness and heart and honesty. So here it's quite a subtle place. It's not easy. And it can easily go one or the other. I remember another meeting also of Dharma teachers in the whole world. This was on Zoom, maybe 8 years ago, whatever, 7 years ago. There were hundreds of Dharma teachers and nearly all the American Dharma teachers were busy all the time with issues of skin color and gender. but more race. And they kept on and on and on and on about it. And we, some of us, sort of, I think the European side, would say, wait a minute, but why is, what about Dharma? You're all going on and on about the social issues in America. But wait, slow down. What about the tools to deal with? Where are the tools? And they were going on and on and on and on about it. And they, too much. Too much. But the opposite can also be a problem. Too little. We go into just, you know, mindful, oh, okay, leave me alone, I'm quiet, and I like silence, and I don't need any of this, and I just meditate, and I just need, as long as I can do a retreat, and everything's cool. We can go into these places, and they're both extremes. And we kind of need to have our dialogue between the relative and the ultimate. We need to be skilled at the dialogue between the relative and ultimate. It's a skill that we can learn. And it will help us enormously in the way we can respond to the challenges of now, whether they're gender, or whether they're climate change, or whether they're violence in the streets. We acknowledge the pain, but we have a bigger consciousness that can hold it. We're not running away from the pain. We're not trying to make it small. We're not trying to avoid anything. But at the same time, we have an awareness and a heart that can hold it. And then go out and do in the world and help and act. So I think in summary, a personal point of view, yes, but not instead of a life point of view. Like the point of view of life looking out of my eyes and the person as well. It's not one instead of the other. So the life point of view and the personal point of view in dialogue. And in play, playful, and playful with it as well. Okay, thank you. So we'll just take a few minutes of quiet.